I want you to know that you have choices now. And I want you to just let that thought resonate for a minute of what that means. Like, you have choices in everything that you decide to do in your treatment and your mental health and how you respond to things. But I want you to remember and hold on to this belief that you have choices now and that you're worth those choices.
Hey, welcome to the Upside of Bipolar, conversations on the road to wellness. I am so excited that you decided to join me today. We're a community learning how to live well with bipolar disorder, and we reject that the best we can expect is learning how to suffer well with it. I'm your host, Michelle Reitinger of MyUpsideOfDown.com, where I help people with bipolar disorder use the map to wellness to live healthy, balanced, productive lives. Welcome to the conversation. Hey, welcome to the Upside of Bipolar. I am your host, Michelle Reitinger, and I have an amazing guest today. This is Megan Saller. Megan is an MSW, ACADC, and I'm going to have you tell us what those are in just a minute. She is an EMDR clinician, trainer, and author who earned her master's degree in clinical social work from Northwestern Nazarene University in 2011. She has been extensively trained in the use of EMDR and other trauma-based interventions, and specializes in the areas of trauma, abuse, attachment, and substance abuse. Megan has trained thousands of clinicians across the U.S. as well as internationally to get the most out of EMDR, trauma, and addiction-based skills and practices. Megan previously owned and operated an extensive outpatient treatment center that was voted best in practice in 2019. She currently owns and operates her own coaching, consulting, and training business, and is passionate about genuinely changing the landscape of mental health and trauma treatment through an authentic, hands-on perspective that is uniquely her own. Megan is the author of the EMDR Workbook for Trauma and PTSD, Skills to Manage Triggers, Move Beyond Traumatic Memories, and Take Back Your Life, released by New Harbinger Publications in May of 2023, and EMDR for Dummies with Wiley Publishing, set to release in June of 2024. Welcome, Megan. I'm so happy you're here.
I am so excited to be here with you and to get to have such a great conversation with you. So thank you for having me.
Now, before we go any further, I want you to tell us, I know what an MCSW is, but I don't know what ACADC. So I think a lot of our audience is going to want to know what that means. What is that?
No, we love those acronyms, right? Medical and mental health world. So all that really is it's an advanced alcohol and drug counselor. So it's essentially just another certification that I've earned that means I'm specialized in treating people with addictive disorders.
That's fantastic. So why don't you tell us your story? We always ask people to start us off with their story.
So yeah, I'm happy to share my story. And I like starting this way because I think it's important as we listen to people to know why we should listen to them. So really, first and foremost, I want you all to know as you're listening that I don't share my story coming at you based on the bio that you just listened to. To me, the experience that I have gained that's been the most valuable has been my own personal messy journey, if you would call it that, and the journeys that I've gotten to witness from those that I've had the opportunity to serve. And so I come from my own complex trauma background. I'm raised with some complex trauma in the home that I grew up in. And I really didn't even know what trauma or domestic violence was at all, even well into a year of getting my master's degree. And as I started to learn about some of those things started to click and make sense for things that I have struggled with for most of my life and, you know, continue to struggle with to some degree, as healing is not a destination, but it's part of our journey, right? And along kind of this trajectory of my own healing and my own life, I've run into lots of barriers because I didn't get the right kind of counseling and therapy that I needed. Sometimes I was resistant to the help that others offered and have kind of just always grown up and even in my adult years, just really feeling misunderstood and struggling with the labels and the judgment that come in the field of mental health that we can kind of fall victim to. And spent a lot of years of my life kind of believing that I was a victim until I've been forced to make some changes in my own personal healing journey that has now inspired me and continues to inspire me to want to help others make the same kind of changes for them so that they can step into their own unique power and gifts.
That's amazing. And it's so interesting. The more people I talk to, the more I recognize that I think some of the most effective people in the psychiatry and mental health and that are people who understand what it feels like. You know, you've been through it yourself and you know what it feels like to feel like a victim and what it feels like to feel like you don't have any answers and nobody understands what you're going through. And one of the things that you said that I think is interesting, I don't know that I've even really thought about this before, is it's hard. If you have a hard time trusting people, it can be very hard to trust somebody to help you, right? And a lot of us who start, especially if you have complex trauma from your childhood, it can make it very difficult for you to be, even to know how to reach out for help. You know, not even just that you're not willing to do it, that you don't even know how to do it, because you have learned in your past that when you ask for help, you get in trouble. You know, and so, you know, has that been something that has played part of your journey? Like, has that been something that you've experienced?
Yeah, 100%. I think that not just not being able to trust others, but not even knowing how to trust myself. Yeah. So then when I make decisions, right, as I've reached out over the last 20 years for help, like, how can I even trust that this is the right person that can help me? Because I'm questioning if I even have the right judgment to make those decisions. And then how can I trust this other person? So it's almost like a double-edged sword. You don't trust yourself, but then you question who you can also trust along the path as well. Because for a lot of us, we've been really wounded and hurt by people that we should have been able to trust or wanted to trust.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that you and I have discussed before is that you... And I want you to talk a little bit more about this, that you started, you know, with as a LCSW, so licensed social worker, correct? Mm-hmm. And saw some issues as you were beginning your, you know, your practice. And that was what led you to seek further education and look for ways to solve the problem. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I'll be really transparent with you guys related to this, which has been a tender subject of mine, but also some of my most powerful areas of growth personally and professionally. But yeah, initially I was an LCSW and I've never fit well into a box, as many of us can probably relate to. And some of the barriers that I found that I've struggled with under that code of ethics. And I understand why we have the code of ethics to help keep people safe and to uphold us to a higher standard. We're just that sometimes people don't heal that way. We need different ways of healing. And some of the most powerful healing that I had personally received is things that weren't just in that 50-to-1-hour session and then feeling like, okay, thanks for sharing your deepest secrets. Have a nice week, right? And then sending them on their way. And I felt bad about that. And then from my own personal trauma, I've struggled with boundaries related to some of those dual relationships as well, because the people that come in, I deeply care about, that open up and are vulnerable about their lives. Like, that matters to me. And honestly, and I don't even think I've told Michelle this, I wanted to step away from that realm. Didn't know how, because we feel kind of bound under those confines of our license. And I actually surrendered my license because of issues with dual relationships. And I stand behind that. And it's been some of my own learning, but it's not something I'll reinstate even when I get to a point where that's an option for me. I feel strongly about changing the landscape of mental health so that we can heal people in a better way, because we're in this mental health epidemic. So whatever we're doing needs to change.
Yeah. And I think one of the biggest barriers to healing is the disease model of, you know, our suffering. You know, we've got this, because we have slapped labels on our symptoms, you know, we group clusters of symptoms together and we put a label on it. It disempowers people. It makes people feel like there's something fundamentally wrong with their brain. It doesn't function in the proper way, which is so ironic, because the brain is doing actually what it's designed to do. It's trying to help you. It's giving you red flags. There's something wrong here. Please help me. And instead of saying, what is it that the brain is trying to tell me? How can we address that? we're told you have a disease that needs to be medicated, and that's the way you're going to be for the rest of your life. And what a horrible, what a horrible prospect, first of all, you know, to be told that this is the rest of your life and you're not going to be able to do anything to change that.
And there's so much judgment and stigma around that too, right? You get those heavy labels and you carry that around, like almost like credentials that you have to like introduce yourself with.
I completely understand what that feels like because I lived that way for so long. You know, for me, one of the things that was really hard, really difficult for me to deal with was feeling like I had no control over myself. And, you know, I would have therapists and doctors that would, you know, tell me that I needed to just make sure my husband understood what was going on. But I could see the damage it was doing to my relationship. And I could see the damage it was doing to my children. And I thought, okay, yes, it's not fair that I have to deal with this, but it's definitely not fair for them. Like, that's not okay. And it just made me feel, I had these conflicting emotions about it. You know, I felt helpless. I felt like a victim, but I could also see that I was victimizing my husband and my children at the same time.
Yeah.
You know? And so I'd like to talk a little bit more about what led you, first of all, to start studying EMDR. You know, there's lots of different therapy modalities. What was it that led you or guided you towards EMDR specifically?
Well, EMDR kind of fell in my lap, to be honest. So I was in a place in my life where I had started some of my own healing work, and kind of like you, I'd run into, you know, gone to therapy, and I was seeing just kind of the atrocities of my life that my own issues and symptoms were causing. And I was practicing at the time, clinician owned the intensive outpatient program that I had. I knew that EMDR was effective. I'd heard about it for years. And one of my closest friends at the time, she was also a therapist. She had, and I always said she was always kind of into like, so she still is into the like weird foo-foo stuff. And we would kind of joke about that, right? And so she had gone down to Arizona and had done a training in EMDR. And she came back and she said, oh my gosh, you have to do this EMDR training. And I'm like, I don't know, you know? And she's like, no, I'm serious. Like, this trainer was amazing. He was like the president of the International Society of EMDR. And like, you need to take this training. And so I kind of like was like, begrudgingly like, okay, because she's like, yeah, we're gonna make arrangements for him to come here to Idaho and do this training. And so I'm like, okay, well, if he's coming here, I'll do it. So I kind of begrudgingly did it. And he asked me to be, and so it's a 5-day training when you go through EMDR. And kind of like initially I was kind of like, yeah, I just can't see my clients coming in and wanting to do eye movements. Or he was training us on like physically tapping and touching our clients, right? And I'm like, I just can't see anyone doing this. Like, it sounds too good to be true. And he asked me on one of the, I think it was the second day of the training, because he must have sensed that I was somewhat like resistant. He said, I want you to be a demo in front of the group, and I'm going to do an EMDR session on you. And the rebellious side of me that I like is like, then I'm going to pick something really hard to be like, does this work? I'm going to test it out, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
So I picked this incident that I had not been able to get over for a decade. And so much so I'd have like panic attacks around this, and really just had been debilitating my life. And we are doing this demo, and I come to this natural conclusion on my own, right? Two things. The first was that God doesn't make junk. And the second was that I can do hard things. And the session was super powerful and moving. And I thought, wow, that was really, really cool experience. And I'll be honest, I still wasn't bought in, because I'm like, I got to test this out. Yeah. And I hadn't been able to go to certain places where I lived because of the debilitating anxiety. I hadn't been able to even drive down certain roads. And to this day, I have zero anxiety around that issue that we targeted. And that was well over 7 years ago. And I just saw how transformative that was. I had been desperate and craving something to just feel like I could fully believe that I was worthwhile, because that's what we all wrestle with trauma. And so when I experienced that, I was like, I'm in. I gotta like do this and help other people feel this way, because we all deserve to feel that.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think is really interesting about your approach to EMDR and as you train other clinicians is that you incorporate not just, it's not straight EMDR, but you incorporate other trauma modalities in that practice, which I think is really fascinating and really wise. You know, I've learned more about different trauma modalities, EMDR was my primary modality. You know, we did some art therapy and, you know, there were a few different like types of therapy that we did along the way, but EMDR was really the trauma therapy that I was utilizing with my therapist. But I want you to talk a little bit about how that came about. You know, how did you start recognizing was that something you were trained on, or was it something that you recognized, you know, it was better to work with these things together? So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, really that came from learning to trust my own intuition and my own, what I've come to recognize from my receiving my own EMDR, what works and what doesn't. And one of the things that I really love about EMDR is it is a client-centered approach, meaning that we all, if you really look at the overall model of EMDR, Francine Shapiro, the developer of it, she really states the importance of every client experiences life and processes and stores things differently. We're unique. And there is not a one size fits all approach that is going to work the same way for two people, even. Like, it should be individual. And what I came to find in my own work, but also as I started to integrate EMDR into practice, is that sometimes that means that people need eclectic approaches, right? Like, I've even used art therapy with EMDR. I've used internal family systems and parts work, which is a common one to use with EMDR, but integrating things that resonate for a client, regardless of what it is, that is so important to tap into their own unique healing. And EMDR gets to be one maybe mode of doing that, but it's important that we use an eclectic approach because I want to get us out of that like disease model, like you talked about, right? Of like, you take medications and you do cognitive behavioral therapy. Like, well, what happens when that doesn't work? Because that's the case a lot of time. And so give people, there is power in giving people a voice to pull from different things that speak and work to them. And so I think that to me is what has made me like EMDR, because it can be out of the box. And I think that's so important.
Yeah. And I would like that. I feel like that's one of the other things that you do really well with your workbook. When I found this workbook, I'm like, I wish I'd had this when I was doing my EMDR, because we have a really unfortunate misconception or lack of understanding, probably is better, about what therapy is. And I struggled with that. I've been very open with that. You know, the first, I don't know, 15 years after my diagnosis, at the beginning, I was extremely resistant to therapy because I didn't understand what it was for. And the idea of opening up to a stranger about the things I was struggling with was very abhorrent to me. And then my parents convinced me to do it. About 3 years after my initial diagnosis, they convinced me to do it because they were worried about what they were seeing in me. You know, I was taking the medications. Nothing was getting better. They were watching. My dad said one time it was like watching a runaway train. And so I agreed to do it just because I didn't want my parents to bug me about it anymore, and had a terrible experience. I was like, see, this is bad. I don't like this anymore. And each time I would have, I think I had like 3 or 4 kind of attempts at therapy over the years. And each time I would have, I would get not very effective therapists. I used to say they were bad therapists, and people take issue with, you know, the word bad, you know, the judgment word bad. But they were not effective. You know, one of them, the worst one, in my opinion, was the one that I would go and talk to her for 50 minutes. And then she would take notes the whole time and then look at the clock and say, oh, time's up. I'll see you next week. And every time I left feeling like, what the heck did I just do? Why am I paying you for this? Like, I can do this for free with somebody else, you know? And so it took a long time for me to figure out how to use therapy, how to be proactive, how to take responsibility for myself. And it goes back to that disease model where somebody else is fixing you. And so I think the reason why I love your trauma workbook so much is that it empowers the person, the individual, to take responsibility for themselves, to become more self-aware, to take hard looks at themselves and learn how to identify, what do I need to take to my therapist? What is it that I'm going to work with them on? Rather than putting it all on the therapist and saying, you're here to fix me. And I'm just going to lay here like a blob and you're going to tell me what I'm supposed to do and what I'm supposed to talk about. So tell me how you came up with the idea for this workbook and how you developed it, because it's really a powerful tool. Anybody who's watching this, I'm going to show you that the workbook looks like. It's really amazing. I'm going through it myself, even though I've already done my EMDR, just because I'm so fascinated by what you've done here.
I'm like, thank you, Michelle. I really appreciate that. And it means a lot coming from you, because I know that you've done so much of your own work. So I appreciate so much you saying everything that you did. So I was actually acquired by New Harbinger to write that book. And funny story, but this acquisitions editor had attended a training I was doing randomly, which they must do when they're looking for people in the field. I was doing a training for PESI, which is a large continuing education provider. I was doing that at the time. And they had this acquisitions editor reached out and said, I like, you know, the simplistic way that you teach these concepts. Would you be willing to write a book on EMDR that's for kind of the client experience? And I really wanted this workbook to embody the lessons that I'd taken away and was still trying to learn in my personal journey, but that I'd also seen be effective for clients that I've worked with. And some of it goes directly back to that disease model, right? Of we kind of have this belief of like, here's your action plan, go to therapy, and right, clients will come in like, you're the professional, tell me what to do, which sure is true to an extent. But, you know, us individually as the client, we're the professional of our own life. Like no one else has lived and been through or wrestled with the things we have. And you're the expert on that internal world. And so there has to be this conjoint relationship and understanding of that. And one of the things that I had learned in EMDR from my mentor was he had always stressed the importance of EMDR. Like, you're not the guide for the client. You're like along for the journey. Like, they're in charge of their treatment and you're just there like to help them if they get stuck. Another colleague of mine, Ariel Schwartz, she says, like, I'm the co-pilot with you, right? Like, the client's the pilot, but you're the co-pilot. And I wanted it to really embody that, because that's one thing that I think we don't do enough in mental health treatment, is like empowering clients to know you have all your own answers and insight. You've tucked it away because you've had to, because of some of your own trauma. And so the goal with the workbook is like, you can uncover that regardless of what you've been labeled with, what you've been diagnosed with. You have so much more power than just a diagnosis. And so the goal for that workbook, again, is really just to help you get back in touch with yourself and take ownership and responsibility back for your life, so that you don't have to be driven by trauma or the symptoms or whatever mental health disorder that you've been labeled with or diagnosed with.
The way that my brain conceptualized, you know, ultimately what therapy was that therapy was a tool and I was looking for a competent facilitator. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have the education or understanding to facilitate my own treatment. And so I was looking for somebody else to facilitate it. Helped me retake that responsibility back to myself and choose. Like, I started learning more about trauma modalities and treatments and therapy. And then I would research, you know, therapists in the area, and I would look for somebody EMDR was the one I settled on, because I'd had a previous therapist that helped me regain my faith in that as a tool for healing. And she had done an EMDR session with me, and I was so amazed by the experience that I was like, ooh, I want to do that again, you know? And so when I moved and I had to start over, I proactively looked for a trauma therapist that was trained in EMDR. I wanted somebody that knew how to use that modality. And I think that one of the things that I love the most about your workbook is there was a section in there where you had people identify their triggers, you know, the trigger and the response and how our bodies were reacting to it. And that is super powerful. I think that, like, again, back with the disease model, we've been led to believe that things like anxiety are a disorder. And it took a long time for me to start recognizing when I had, you know, and I finally got to a point like, oh, that's a trauma response. What happened that triggered a trauma response in me? But it was after a lot of work and a lot of healing, you know, and I started recognizing stimulus and response, you know, the things that were happening. Mm-hmm. And it didn't always make sense. You know, I think that's one of the other things is that oftentimes the trigger is not a logical trigger. It's not like, oh, you know, this thing happened because somebody yelled at me. And I remember my mom yelled at me when I was a child. And so my body had a reaction. You know, for me, I had a numbing experience where I couldn't feel emotions talking to my daughter, of all things. And I held shame around that experience for years and didn't tell anybody about it because I thought, I'm like, there's something wrong with me. That is not normal for a mom to not be able to feel emotion towards her child. And when I finally was willing to talk to my therapist about it and work on it, we realized that it went back to abuse that I had experienced in my first marriage, which seemed totally unrelated. I'm like, how does that affect my relationship with my daughter? Right? Mm-hmm. So what in your experience, I mean, is there, I think that's one of the biggest problems we have in trauma healing and that kind of thing, is this barrier to understanding like what's actually happening to us.
Yeah. I'm so glad you brought this up. And I was jotting down a couple things that I wanted to touch on with this. And I want our listeners to know first and foremost, and I don't think this is shared enough. And one of the things to keep in mind is that, yes, as mental health professionals, we've gone to school, we understand symptomology and diagnosing. But what I want you to know as the listener is that a lot of the times, and this is true for most programs, you do one trauma class your entire 2 years master's education level. And then when you get out of school with your master's and you go into practice and you're seeing clients, a lot of the times, and at least this is how it is in this area, supervisors or people that you first work with, they're like, if anyone comes in with trauma, you know, you need to pass that off to a more experienced clinician. Well, then how do we ever get experienced with working with trauma if we're always afraid to kind of like touch trauma or we think it's more advanced? And a lot of that just comes down to, we don't know what we don't know because we didn't receive that education. So a lot of our education is around that diagnosing, how to use like, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy and solution focused and maybe some other of those modalities. But there is a lack of education around trauma, and even more so for medical providers. Like, keep in mind that they do, I think, one trauma class like for one semester in their whole medical career. And so when they're giving you a diagnosis, like really be mindful of like, okay, or ask, what does this person, what experience do they have in the psychiatric realm? Because I see that misdiagnosing so much and it makes me crazy as a provider. Because one of the things that we know now about trauma is that trauma mimics so many other mental health disorders. The symptoms of trauma will show up like bipolar disorder. Really, if they're left untreated, it will literally look like bipolar disorder because you'll have a trigger like Michelle was just talking about. And maybe it leads you into this state of kind of dorsal depression, or you get flooded with this flight of kind of anxiety, and it can kind of appear like mania. It can look like major depressive disorder. It can look like generalized anxiety disorder. One of the ones that I hate personally that we label people with is borderline personality disorder, which is really just a trauma disorder if we really look at the origins of it. So keep in mind that a lot of the times, if trauma hasn't been screened and ruled out for you, explore that for yourself. That's so important. And it can take some of that stigma away. It can be overwhelming to have a trauma diagnosis, but there's healing with trauma. Your body has the ability, your brain has the ability to change and heal itself. Speaking of triggers, this is another misconception, right? A lot of the times when you go into counseling, we're like, tell me what your triggers are. And even if you were to ask me or Michelle that, we've done a lot of work, right? We might be able to list like a couple, like it would take a minute to think on them. But one of the misconceptions with this and within trauma and the neurobiology of how trauma is really stored is that trauma is not stored like a story narrative, right? It doesn't have a beginning, middle, and end. Trauma is stored in your senses. So when you go through a negative experience, your body is doing this inventory, right? It's remembering everything that was said, everything you heard, the noises. It's remembering smells. It's remembering the physical sensations of maybe like where you were, the temperature. And it's going to store all of that sensory information in the five senses. And then maybe just one of those things in the future, like you smell, maybe like I always use this example in trainings, like you get in a car accident, let's say, and then years later, you smell this like burning oil and instantly you start to feel your heart race and you're like, oh my gosh, why am I feeling anxious? This is so weird, because you're not connecting. Like your brain is going, well, the last time we smelled, you know, burning oil like this, we were almost in a state of like death or whatever it could have been, right? And so keep in mind that triggers oftentimes are sensory based. And so when you go through or experience that kind of startle response, whether you shut down, like Michelle said, you find yourself being anxious, do like a sensory inventory. Like, hey, what senses stood out to me? And that can help you start to kind of uncover or lead you to maybe what that actual trigger is and what it's connected to, so that you can kind of do some work on that and resolve it.
Yeah. And one of the things that was so powerful for me, when I was doing the very first time that I did EMDR as a, you know, with my therapist, I for weeks had been coming in and obsessively talking about a specific topic. And it was, and I was sick of talking about it. And I even told her, I'm like, I don't want to talk about this anymore. Why does this keep coming up? Like, I will be driving to therapy and think I am not going to talk about that. And like 10 minutes into the session, I'm talking about it again. And so she, that was when she said, let's, and she was not fully certified as a therapist. She was doing her hours to get her certification. So she was still in the beginning, but she had been trained in EMDR. And she said,
I'm like, good for her. Yeah,
I know. And she said, let's explore this a little bit. And I was like, I didn't want to. I'm like, no, I don't want to talk about it anymore. She said, there's a reason your brain keeps bringing it up. Let's look at this. And so she had me close my eyes and be still for a minute. And she said, I want you to think about how you feel when we talk about this. And then I want you to think back to the earliest time you can remember feeling this way. And that was such an interesting experience, because the experience that I was having currently was not at all related to the experience I remembered as a child. They were completely, if I looked at them on paper, they were completely unrelated to each other. But when we went down and processed, and the experience I had as a child, I would not have said that was a traumatic experience. That's not how I would have framed that experience for myself. But as a child, that's how I experienced it. And by processing that younger experience, it completely resolved this issue that I was struggling with currently. And I think that's one of the big drawbacks of talk therapy and these types of therapy that are focusing on what's happening in your conscious mind, because subconscious mind is in control.
Yeah,
as much as we want to believe that we can.
Even higher, like I think it might even be higher. Your subconscious rules your thought life. And yeah. Then normal talk therapy, right? That's like, we're only working with like 1-5% of like your actual working memory in that place.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the big misconceptions about therapy. And, you know, people will, I had one woman I was talking to that had been in therapy for 20 years, and she was, you know, she and I were talking and she said, well, you know, my therapist helps me, you know, the therapy in her mind, therapy was for learning coping skills. And I thought, okay, that's a tiny bit of what you should be doing in therapy, but that's only so that you can cope with what you're dealing with as you go through the healing process. Like, that is not the point. That should not be the end of therapy. That means you are going to be in therapy for the rest of your life, mm-hmm. because you're never going to identify what's causing you to have these symptoms that you need to cope with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to talk a little bit, that would be really helpful, actually, I think, if we talk a little bit about, you know, what's happening in your conscious mind with talk therapy versus what's happening in your subconscious mind, because we talk about that. I see a lot of stuff online, and we don't necessarily need to talk about, you know, sympathetic and parasympathetic. I think that gets confusing for people a lot of times. But
it's still confusing for
our
me.
Subconscious.
You can't use, yeah. I can't use that terminology. I have to use it differently. So yeah.
But our subconscious mind is designed to protect us. That's what our body is designed. Our subconscious mind is designed to protect us. And the problem is that when we have situations that are not resolved, and our subconscious mind is constantly on the alert for anything that it thinks is related, because it's like, okay, this was a scary experience. This was bad. This was dangerous. You know, it was life-threatening. Even if it wasn't literally, that's what it perceived it as. It's going to look for anything that it feels like might, you know, present that same threat. And that's why, like you said, the five senses, like it's looking for the smells, the feeling, the, you know, the sounds, those kinds of things. And it perceives that, and it's like, oh, we're in danger, and it puts you into fight or flight or freeze.
Yeah.
And when you try to resolve that on a conscious level, you are not getting down to the subconscious mind where that stuff lives.
Well, and you can't even really access that. You know, I talk about this a lot in trainings when I'm trying to help clinicians understand, because, you know, just like you said, when you shared this experience with this woman that's come in and, you know, she's been in therapy like for the rest of her life, we'll see that a lot. And a lot of the clinicians that come and end up getting trained by me in trauma or EMDR, one of the really important pieces that I want them to understand is that, just like you're talking about, that subconscious mind, right? We have to be able to access that. But what happens is when we've gone through trauma, or especially complex, which just means ongoing trauma, like we've had multiple trauma after multiple trauma and we've never resolved it. If you really do, if you look at brain scans, like what we know is that there's very like little to no activation occurring in the frontal lobe. And this is important because this is where we make decisions. We can retain new skills that we're taught, like maybe coping skills that we learn in therapy. That part of the brain has to be online in order for a client or for you to even learn and retain a new skill that might help you with relaxation or whatever it might be, right? That has to be able to be accessed. But when we have unresolved trauma, the brain isn't concerned about learning and saving new information. It's concerned about your safety. And so we can't even access that ability of the brain that we need as we're teaching some of the skills that we're trained to teach as therapists, right? And so what I like to tell people is that if you can start with getting in and doing the work with the subconscious, identifying some of those triggers, those sensations, the meaning and perception that you've given things, right, is important. And do something like EMDR or other trauma work that helps kind of sort and clear some of that out. Then later you can teach, your brain will be more online and clients and you personally might be able to retain more information around coping skills. Those things might actually start to work. But until you do the trauma work and you sort out kind of the stuff that's there underneath the surface of your just basic thought life, you're not going to be able to see that progress that you're searching for.
Yeah. And, you know, interestingly, as you're talking about that, I was thinking about, you know, you're talking about how in brain scans, we can see that the conscious part of the brain, you know, the decision-making part of the brain is not even activated. And that's why I love, like, EMDR was so effective for me, because it was getting down underneath my subconscious, you know, into the subconscious. It was getting down to what I was feeling and what I was experiencing. And it wasn't an easy thing to go through. One of the things that was so interesting is, so I've been to two therapists now that practice EMDR, and both of them had very different approaches. And I've heard, you know, I've had people respond to posts that I've put up about EMDR, and they were like, I tried EMDR and it didn't work. And one of the thoughts that I had was, maybe try a different therapist that does EMDR, you know, that it's, and EMDR is not, every person is not going to respond to it. You know, there are, like you said, all of our brains, you know, store information differently, work differently. We process things differently. And so it is possible that, you know, somebody, that's just not a great modality for somebody. But listening to you and learning about your approach to training therapists with EMDR, I love that you're incorporating IFS, you know, internal family systems and parts therapy. I feel like instead of like isolating these different pieces, if we can incorporate them and find an approach that will help each individual and personalize that treatment model rather than, you know, saying you got to fit inside this box. And if you don't fit inside this box, then it doesn't work for you. So what would you recommend to somebody who maybe has tried EMDR or didn't work for them and, you know, is still struggling with unhealed trauma? You know, what would you recommend that they do?
Yeah, my first question anytime someone tells me that they tried EMDR and it didn't work is I always ask, did your clinician do any resourcing with you? And if you went to EMDR and you had a negative experience and I just said that and you're like, I don't know what that means, then that probably means no. And this is one of the number one reasons that EMDR will be a negative experience for you. And what resourcing really means is, like, did you do an exercise like Calm or Safe Place? Were you taught something called Container? Were you, like, kind of developed, like, these, like, guided little meditation approaches that prepared you for EMDR? Because EMDR is more than just doing like a trauma session. There's front loading work that needs to be done. And where I see people have negative EMDR experiences is that the clinicians weren't trained enough in how important building and developing some positive like resourcing and experiencing is for clients. So if you didn't do that with your EMDR therapist, that's a problem. And give it another shot with a different EMDR therapist. If you're like, how do I even know? I'm like, send me an email and I can always, in your area, I can always refer EMDR clinicians that I know are trained and do the EMDR approach the way that it's intended to be. And then also don't be disheartened. Even if you went and did EMDR and you did like the typical resourcing and you went through some of it and you just didn't like it, that's okay. What I like about that answer is that at least you know what doesn't work for you and you're getting one step closer to finding what does work for you. But it's not a pass or a fail thing. And one of the things that I appreciate about the model of EMDR is that we really stress of you can't do EMDR wrong. Like there isn't a right or a wrong way to do EMDR. Whatever you find or discover in that process has meaning and purpose and it's right for you. It tells part of your story or it leads you closer to finding a solution that's going to work for you, even if it's not EMDR. So keep that in mind as well.
Yeah, I love that because you know, it goes back to this idea of taking responsibility for your healing journey and not putting that on the therapist. You know, it's you make the decision. You are the one choosing your therapist. If you get a therapist that you don't trust or you don't like, or it doesn't work for you, think, okay, it's not that therapy doesn't work. It's that particular therapist was not a good facilitator for me. They were not, we don't work well together, or they are not effective as a facilitator, right? And that happens too, because we have people that are good at their jobs and people that are bad at their jobs.
Yeah, you have to meet someone you click with that you have a good relationship with. It's the same way with therapists, right? They could be a great therapist, but if you don't feel like you're connecting with them, they're not the therapist for you, because that relationship piece is huge and crucial.
The other thing that I've also found is that sometimes people find a therapist they really love, but they don't have the training that they need in order to help them. And we have to remember, this is not about as much. I mean, it is important to have a good relationship with the therapist, but that relationship should not be for the rest of your life. You should not be thinking this is going to be somebody I'm going to be talking to forever. I had one therapist one time that introduced me to EMDR, who said, my job is to have you put me out of a job. Meaning my job is to make sure that you don't need me anymore. I don't want you to be dependent on me for the rest of your life.
Yes.
And so, you know, that made me have a lot more confidence in her because I had never had anybody say that to me before. I also love that she set therapy goals with me. And she said, we might need to reevaluate these. Things are going to evolve. And that's one thing I've also discovered is that your therapy goals should evolve, because usually what you go into to work on in the beginning isn't actually the source of the issue. It's usually like a surface issue.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to kind of dig down to see what is the origin of that issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, oh my gosh, I could talk to you forever. This is such a great conversation.
I love this conversation. I could keep it going too. I appreciate this openness about these real issues that we face in this world.
I'm really curious about your EMDR for Dummies. I'd love for you to tell us what that's about.
Yeah, I'm actually so excited about the EMDR for Dummies book. It's been really fun to write, and I love it because it's so simplistic. It breaks EMDR down. It's really written for both the clinician and the client in mind, and it goes through EMDR in kind of a step-by-step approach of like, here's how we gather trauma. I mean, I don't recommend doing EMDR on your own ever. I always think right. That should be done with someone that has received training for that, right? And a coach or a clinician or whatever it is with the right type of experience. But it walks you through how to go through that and how to work through barriers that you run into in your trauma journey or even within using EMDR. And it also addresses how to use EMDR, not just for trauma, but for a variety of other things like anxiety. It integrates, there's a whole section that talks about different parts work from an IFS approach. It looks at ways to even just reduce your stress level without getting into maybe a major trauma, but just to get you like more regulated. There's some exercises on that. So it's a big, bulky book, but it is really, it's kind of designed like all for Dummies books are like a cookbook. So you can go to the front, like, here's what we're trying to work on and work on that particular issue or use some of those skills in conjunction with your own healing.
I can't wait for that book to come out. I'm like, as you're describing, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is going to be so fun to read. Yeah. So the last thing that I want to talk about is you said at the beginning that this idea that we arrive at healing is a misunderstanding of what the healing process looks like, that it's a continuous journey. And that's not meant to make people feel like, oh, you're never going to heal. But I've learned that myself. You know, I've discovered we are super complex beings. Our minds are so complex. Our life experiences are so varied and complex. And a lot of times we start with, you know, especially if you've got unhealed trauma and things have piled on top of it, you know, you've got coping mechanisms and other life experiences and all these things that just keep kind of building and making this bigger and more onerous. As you go to therapy, be really patient with the process, you know, recognize you might, you know, I did EMDR for a small trauma and started to, you know, over time, I did it a couple more times and it helped me gain confidence in that process. And so by the time I was like started recognizing my life was still being affected by a massive unhealed trauma from almost 30 years ago, I was ready to do it. And it helped me gain confidence in that. But even after I had done that, you know, a month and a half of, you know, intensive EMDR treatment for that, I had, you know, about 6 or 7 months later, another thing kind of resurfaced and I needed to go back and do that. And it wasn't, I recognized the value of what I was doing and I was moving forward and I was healing and I was, you know, getting healthier and more balanced. But that if we get the idea in our head that we're going to arrive at healing at some point, it can make the journey feel more discouraging, I think. And yeah. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, because I think that that's one of the things that creates a barrier to the process for people is this kind of misunderstanding of what healing looks like.
Yeah. We think it's some destination that you're supposed to arrive at. And, you know, to be really honest, if those of you that have experienced any difficult circumstances in life, whether you identify it as trauma or not, there's pressure when we experience the challenges of life, right? That lead us to feeling pressure to be perfect or to set these expectations. And what I want you to know as you're listening to Michelle and I talk about this is I say that the healing journey, you know, might last your whole lifetime to remove that pressure and expectation. Like your story matters and it is not something to be rushed through. Like you deserve the time and the attention that treatment and patience takes. And for a lot of us, we've never had the focus be on us, or we don't know how to even do it appropriately or the right way when we've come from a traumatic background or had negative life experiences happen. But you deserve that time. You deserve time on yourself. You deserve to be patient in the process, right? Nothing ever is that great when we rush through it, and know that it does just take some ongoing work and that matters and it's important. Like you matter, you're important, you're worth that time and energy. And as you go through the healing journey, it doesn't mean that it always stays hard. It's like what Michelle says, right? You might get to a really good place for like 6 months or a year, and then something pops up because life is messy and complicated. And then you go back and address that. But just take that and remove that pressure to be like truly healed or better. Like you're already perfect the way you are. Like let's just work from building you up and getting you to believe in yourself more so that when those challenges arrive, you know what to do with them.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that I love about this, you know, process is that along the way you get to places where you are able to experience joy consistently. You know, you're able to experience a healthy, balanced mindset. You're able to handle stress better. You know, that was, I think, the biggest gift of this process for me is being able to handle stress and being able to handle things that I don't have control over. You know, I spent so much time being so carefully guarded about, you know, my emotional resources and, you know, setting all these boundaries and that. And I'm that is not a bad thing necessarily. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but it takes a lot of energy. And I was so grateful when I got to a point where I didn't have to be that vigilant because I was able to handle stressors. I was able to handle things that were beyond my control. I was able to handle hard things. And that's the beauty of this healing journey is as you do the work, as you're willing to go through the hard things that lead to, you know, healing certain triggers, healing certain, you know, processing, you know, trauma and those kinds of things, it frees you so that you are not at the mercy of these emotional responses all the time, and you are able to handle stress. You're able to be more resilient as you, you know, in your process, in your journey of life.
Yeah, and celebrate those little victories, like Michelle just said. I'll share an example of this really quickly, because just like on my own healing journey, I still have times where I get my feathers ruffled, or I can get so anxious, right? And things that used to maybe once debilitate me. And yesterday, I had a circumstance that came up, and I was so anxious. I had been nervous about it, but I kind of pushed through and did it anyways. And I got back to my car when I was done, and I was like, in my head, as silly as this was, because it wasn't even a big deal, I was like, you did it, right? Like, you did it. Like, you did it. You faced your anxiety and it's over. And I've learned that if I give myself the credit and I celebrate the tiniest victory of even just like pushing through something that's anxious, right, that normally I would avoid or run from, that I gain more confidence in myself to handle those stressors in the future. So it's really important to celebrate those tiny victories, even when you face some challenges that, you know, are difficult or have been life-altering in the past for you.
Awesome. Megan, you are amazing. And I'm so happy that we met each other. I'm so happy that we got to talk today. And I can't wait to, I'm sure I'll have you on again, especially when your book comes out. I can't wait for that. Like, I'm super excited about it.
Be on again, and I know that we're going to do some great future work together. So I hope all the listeners will stay tuned for that as well.
Yeah. So what is one thing that somebody can do today that will help move forward along this path to taking ownership and responsibility for your healing process?
This is a powerful thing that one of my most dear mentors and people in my life told me. And I want you to know the same thing, you that are listening. I want you to know that you have choices now. And I want you to just let that thought resonate for a minute of what that means. Like, you have choices in everything that you decide to do in your treatment and your mental health and how you respond to things. But I want you to remember and hold on to this belief that you have choices now and that you're worth those choices.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Megan. Where can people find you?
You can find me at thementalsurvivalist.com, and you can find me on LinkedIn at Megan Solar or The Mental Survivalist, as well as on Instagram at The Mental Survivalist.
Awesome. Thank you so much. This has been amazing. I really appreciate you.
Yeah, I appreciate you and all the work you're doing, and thank you for a great discussion today.
Yeah. All right. Until next time, Upsiders. Hey, thanks for joining us today. If you're ready to start on your path to wellness with bipolar, go to myupsideofdown.com and get your free mood cycle survival guide, 4 steps to successfully navigate bipolar mood swings. If you're ready for more, check out the map to wellness. Until next time, Upsiders.